Lecture 6. Mapping American Dialects.
What dialect do you speak? Let's take a quiz. The New York Times dialect quiz, to be exact. It came out back in 2013, and it was wildly popular. As of 2015, it's still available on the newspaper's website and as the U.S. dialect app. The quiz generates heat maps of the regional distribution of various dialect features. It also produces a final map showing where your various features converge. So let's walk through a few questions. Question 1. How would you address a group of two or more people? It's multiple choice, so we can pick from you all, yous, you lot, you guys, you-uns, yins, you, other, or y'all. So my answer is you all. Question 2. What do you call the insect that flies around in the summer and glows in the dark? The choices are lightning bug, firefly, peony wally, lightning bug and firefly interchangeably, no word for this, or other. I say lightning bug. Question 3. What do you call a big road on which you drive relatively fast? The choices are highway, freeway, parkway, turnpike, expressway, throughway. A freeway is bigger than a highway. Freeway is free and a highway isn't. Freeway has limited access, whereas a highway can have stoplights and intersections. Or other. My choice is highway. Question 4. What do you call the long sandwich that contains cold cuts, lettuce, and so on? Do you call it a sub, grinder, hoagie, hero, poor boy, bomber, Italian sandwich, baguette, sarnie, no word for this, or other? I call it a sub. Question 5. How do you pronounce B-E-E-N? The vowel in sit, the vowel in see, the vowel in set, or other? I say bin, so the vowel in sit. So, 20 more questions later, and I get a heat map of the U.S. centered on Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina. Not bad. I was born in Baltimore, grew up on the Delmarva Peninsula, and spent a number of years in North Carolina. Now, I've talked to a lot of people who've taken this quiz, including a lot of my fellow sociolinguists, and it's pretty accurate. Even in this day and age of social media and population mobility, it's still possible to tell a lot about where someone's from based on the words they use, their pronunciations, and their grammatical patterns from their dialect. But how do we do this? How do sociolinguists, dialectologists, and dialect geographers come up with their dialect maps? Well, they often start with what we just did, a dialect survey. Building from items they know or suspect will show variation, they design and administer questionnaires. Results are compiled, plotted on maps, and then dialect lines can be drawn. You can then take what you've learned about the regional distribution of dialect features to pinpoint, or at least get a sense of, where a particular person's from based on their answers. The quiz I just described may seem like a silly game, but there's actually sound linguistic science behind it. It's based on the Harvard Dialect Survey, a comprehensive survey of U.S. regional dialect variation conducted in 2003 by linguists Bert Vaux and Scott Golder. The quiz and accompanying heat maps come from Joshua Katz, a statistician and expert in graphic visualizations. The Harvard Dialect Survey map represents just a handful of the countless maps of U.S. dialects and dialect features compiled by sociolinguists and dialect geographers over the decades. The various maps have a lot in common, but they do have their differences. But why are they different, if they're all mapping dialects across the same geographic space? Well, for one thing, different dialect geographic projects focus on different types of linguistic features. Remember that dialects are composed of pronunciation features, grammatical constructions, and lexical items. One highly authoritative source for dialect maps that focuses on phonological features, pronunciations, is the Atlas of North American English by sociolinguists William LaBove, Sharon Ash, and Charles Boberg. You can find an overview map of North American dialects online by going to the homepage for the Atlas, clicking on the Dialects of North America, then on North American English Dialects. The map shows the major U.S. dialect areas, the South, North, Midland, in the eastern half of the U.S., and a very large West in the other. A good source for maps showing the regional distribution of various grammatical features is the Yale Grammatical Diversity Project, led by linguists Jim Wood and Raffaella Zanutini. If you go to the project website and click on Phenomena, you can generate maps by clicking on the various grammatical constructions listed. So, for example, a prefixing, as in he was a huntin' and a fishin', or multiple modals in something like I might could help you or I might should better try. Hint, this last feature is found mostly in the South, especially the Texas South. Now, the source for dialect words is the Dictionary of American Regional English, or what we call DARE. DARE is a fascinating compilation of American English words and phrases that show regional or social variation. It's a compendious 6-volume set that took decades to put together. There are lots of maps to go with the lexical entries, but they look pretty different from other dialect maps. And not just because they're focused on lexical items rather than pronunciation or grammar, but because DARE doesn't use regular maps. It uses its own maps, in which the U.S. states are resized based on their population density. They can be a little hard to read at first, since geographically large states like Texas can show up as quite small if their population density is low. Relatively small states like New York are now proportionally huge. If you'd like to see what a DARE map looks like, go to the website for the Dictionary of American Regional English, click on Maps, and start exploring. You can check out the regional distributions of a number of interesting lexical items, anything from Jersey mosquito to flannel cake to blue norther. Now, I could keep you in suspense, but just so you know, a Jersey mosquito is a large mosquito found in the northeastern U.S. A flannel cake is an Appalachian word for a coarse oat cake. And blue norther? That's a strong wind they talk about in Texas, maybe similar to a northeaster or norther, alternate terms used in other parts of the country. The Harvard survey, the survey behind the New York Times dialect quiz, has now morphed into the Cambridge Online Survey of World Englishes, and it includes maps for all three types of dialect features. So, in the quiz I just took, lightning bug, highway, and sub are lexical items. Bin versus bean is a pronunciation variation, and you all, for plural you, is a grammatical feature. The different dialect maps also differ in terms of how the data were gathered. Survey questionnaires are quite common, whether administered by internet, by phone, in person, or even by mail. Some surveys, like the one we just took, involve multiple choice questions. Others are more open-ended, and respondents are given questions, but not possible answers. Or they might get fill-in-the-blanks. Here's an interesting one from the Survey of Oklahoma Dialects, conducted in the 1990s by sociolinguist Guy Bailey and his colleagues. So here's the question. When are you most likely to hear an owl hoot? Are there actually different terms for night in Oklahoma? Well, actually, no. This is a trick question. What Bailey was looking for was actually a pronunciation, not a lexical item. He wanted to know whether people said night or gnat, the more southern pronunciation. So he hid the question, not to be devious, but to keep people from being too self-conscious and maybe avoiding a pronunciation they felt might be stigmatized. That's a problem in general with dialect surveys. How do you know that what people say they do with language is what they actually do? Maybe they avoid claiming features that they think might be wrong, like gnat for night, or grammatical features like y'all for plural you. Or maybe they say they do use features when they really don't. Another issue is that there might be more than one right answer, but you're only allowed to pick one. Maybe you use two terms interchangeably, or one word in one situation and another in a different context, maybe to indicate a different meaning. Or maybe, once you start thinking about it, you're no longer sure which word you use. I had this problem with another Cambridge survey question. What's the term for a sale of unwanted items on your porch, in your yard, etc.? Now, I think I use both yard sale and garage sale, but I'm not really sure. And then there's the problem of dialect pronunciations. These can be pretty difficult to depict or decipher using regular orthography rather than phonetic symbols. Bin versus bean isn't too bad, but what if my pronunciation falls somewhere in between? But these issues aside, survey questionnaires are a very useful tool for dialect geographers. They can give us a lot of data on many dialect features over a wide area in a relatively short time. They may be a bit artificial, but if you just go around listening for particular dialect features in real-life interactions, you may or may not hear them. After all, people don't always talk about lightning bugs, Jersey mosquitoes, and yard sales, or at least I don't. Sociolinguists also use informal interviews, basically recorded conversations, as a compromise between just listening in and sitting people down and going through lists of survey questions. But conversational data is more useful for pronunciation features than lexical items, since again, it's not likely that all the words you're interested in would just happen to come up. Pronunciations aren't a problem. No matter what I'm talking about, I'm going to use a full range of vowels and consonants. I can't talk without them. The Atlas of North American English used phone interviews, supplemented with a few fill-in-the-blanks and direct questions, asking people whether they do or do not use particular features. These are so-called self-report questions. The Dictionary of American Regional English also used interviews as one of its data sources. It also relied on written records of dialect usages, gathered by the dictionary-making team and sent into the DARE office by scholars and other interested parties. A third source of data was observations on dialect usages by members of the American Dialect Society, the organization that actually initiated the DARE project. Founded in 1889, the American Dialect Society is dedicated to the study of the English language in North America and of other languages or dialects of other languages, influencing it or influenced by it. It's an august organization, and it's still going strong. Its annual Word of the Year vote is a major media event. So dialect maps differ in terms of what types of features they focus on and how data are gathered. Questionnaire, interview, writings, observations, or some combination of those. A third difference across dialect maps involves different ways of depicting the distribution of features and dialect areas. Traditional dialect maps show lines around dialect areas, just like lines around states and other political boundaries, or lines indicating rivers and coastlines. These boundaries are determined by charting survey responses and drawing lines between the use of one feature and the use of another. So y'all versus you all, lightning bug versus firefly, northeaster versus norther, and so on. Sociolinguists call these dividing lines isoglosses, sort of like lines on a weather map, isobars and isotherms. When isoglosses for a number of dialect features come together to form a bundle of isoglosses, we draw a thicker line, a dialect dividing line, and soon we can separate our map into dialect areas. But things aren't always that clear-cut. Often, transitions between one dialect feature and another are more gradual than abrupt, and there are transition zones between dialect areas. In these zones, we find alternations between linguistic variants. Different people might use different variants, and even a single individual might sometimes use one variant and sometimes another. In the case of phonological features, we might find dialectally intermediate forms. For example, one of the pronunciation features separating the major U.S. dialects from one another is whether or not people pronounce the vowel in word pairs like caught and caught the same or different. You can hear my pronunciation. I say them differently. Caught the ball and slept on a cot. But you, or someone you know, might pronounce them the same, caught and caught. The Midland dialect area, between the North and the South, is something of a transition area for this feature, where some people have two different pronunciations, some have just one, and some have something in between. Drawing dialect lines is also complicated by the fact that dialects are not composed solely of unique features, features found only in one dialect and no other. Instead, they mix and match features. What makes each dialect unique is the constellation of features it comprises, not a long list of features it keeps just to itself. For example, New York City English shares our listeners with Boston English, with pockets of Southern English, with African American English, and even with British English. It also shares a distinctive pronunciation for I, almost an oi sound, with certain Southern coastal dialects, as in something like roid for ride. But we don't confuse New York City English with Southern English, not even close. That's because New York City English has other features it shares with different dialects. For example, it shares Yiddish-derived vocabulary words like schlep and chutzpah with Jewish-American communities throughout the U.S. And it has unique features, too. But again, what's really unique about New York City English is its unique combination of features, and that goes for any dialect. So how do we capture the mixing and matching on a dialect map? One way to avoid oversimplifying is to plot each individual survey respondent's usage for each feature as a point. This is what the Harvard, Cambridge, and Yale dialect surveys do. The points can then be used to generate a map for each dialect feature of interest. So, for example, a map of sub versus hoagie, or one for caught-caught different and caught-caught same. And then there's a so-called great pop versus soda controversy. What's your term for a sweetened carbonated beverage? You can go to the website for the Cambridge Online Survey of World Englishes to see where you fit in. We can also depict variant usages as heat maps, where each variant of a particular feature, pop, soda, coke, soft drink, is represented by a different color, and probability or proportionality of usage in a given geographic area is represented by degree of shading, with darker areas indicating heavier usage and lighter areas lighter usage. We can also start overlaying or layering our feature maps. When we do this, we'll begin to see that despite all the mixing and matching, different areas will have different features in common, and so dialect regions will emerge. Using this layering technique, areas with the highest concentrations of regionally specific dialect features are called primary dialect areas. Those with few features are secondary areas, and we can go down from there to tertiary and even quaternary areas. For example, dialectologist Craig Carver created maps using layers of shared lexical items. His map of the U.S. West shows that the West as a primary dialect area. It has three secondary areas, the Northwest, Central West, and Southwest. There are three tertiary areas under the Central West, Utah, Colorado, and Northern California. Under the Southwest, we find the California Southwest and the Texas Southwest. And in turn, the Texas Southwest subdivides into three quaternary areas, West Texas, Central Texas, and South Texas. We can visualize this layered or hierarchical map in a couple of ways. As a map with different degrees of shading, with darkest for primary, lightest for quaternary, or we can visualize it as a tree with west at the top, branching into the northwest, central west, and southwest, and then tertiary and quaternary branches below these. Carver's layered map of the U.S. is a great illustration of how different dialect maps can look depending on where you're focused and what types of features you're focusing on. His map shows a U.S. West that's rich with dialect differentiation. In contrast, the overview map in the Atlas of North American English, which focuses on pronunciation systems and also on larger population centers, shows a single undifferentiated West. Now, neither map is right or wrong. Again, it's a matter of what you're looking at and what aspects of dialect variation you want to emphasize. There's no single ideal way for mapping regional dialect variation, just as there's no single ideal method for gathering the data behind the dialect points, or lines, or layered visualizations. So you might find that if you take the New York Times dialect quiz more than once, you get different results each time. I know I did, especially the more I think about it and the less sure I become of what my real answers actually are. Now, this doesn't mean the quiz is flawed. It means that dialect boundaries are fuzzy and individuals are individuals. We all have different influences impinging on our dialects, and that includes a lot more than just region. There's also social status, ethnicity, gender, age, and even personality. And there are situational and attitudinal effects, too. People taking dialect surveys might not claim features they think are stigmatized, and they might try to avoid these features in real life, too, even if they're a natural part of their home dialect. Conversely, Americans can feel pretty positive about dialect differences. This may seem contradictory, but it's also just true. For decades, sociolinguists have been studying and mapping not only how people use dialects, but how they feel about them. A pioneer in the field of mapping dialect perceptions is sociolinguist Dennis Preston. Preston and his colleagues have designed and conducted numerous studies designed to get at how people from different parts of the U.S. perceive dialect differences on several dimensions. For example, Preston administers mapping tasks in which participants are asked to draw maps indicating what and where they think U.S. dialects are. In other tasks, he has people rate speakers from different regions along a number of dimensions. For example, correctness, standardness, pleasantness, friendliness, and so on. He then compiles maps based on these judgments. Still other studies in so-called perceptual dialectology involve having people identify speakers' dialects based on voice alone, including not only regional dialects, but also ethnic and other social dialects. There's a good bit of variation in how non-linguists draw dialect maps, depending on where they're from, among other factors. Just about everyone recognizes a southern dialect region, but people from more southerly areas tend to draw a bigger southern dialect area than those from more northerly areas, who draw bigger circles around their home dialect region. There's also regional variability in terms of dialect attitudes. For example, Preston conducted a study in which he asked residents of Michigan and Alabama to rate each of the 50 states in terms of correctness and pleasantness on a 10-point scale. The Michiganders were more judgmental in terms of correctness, with ratings ranging from a high of 9 all the way down to a low 3. Their pleasantness ratings covered a smaller range, with a low of only 4. On the other hand, Alabama residents were more forgiving in terms of correctness, but a bit harsher in terms of the states they rated least pleasant, one of which, coincidentally enough, was Michigan. So for correctness, their ratings range from 9 to 4, but for pleasantness, they range from 9 all the way down to 3. Preston created maps depicting these ratings, providing a clear picture of just how different people's language attitudes can be in different regions. These differences aside, studies like Preston's have found that the various adjectives people use to evaluate regional dialects can almost always be collapsed into these same two dimensions, correctness and pleasantness, often called status and affect. And in many cases, positive ratings on the affect scale are inversely correlated with positive ratings on the status scale. So the same dialects that we really like, that we think of as more pleasant than other dialects, are also the ones we think of as least rather than most correct. This is especially true for that most noticeable of all American dialects, Southern English. People really like it. They rate it as pleasant, homey, down-to-earth, authentic, and all kinds of other good things. But at the same time, they also think of it as incorrect, non-standard, uneducated, even lazy and stupid. So regional dialects can be something of a double-edged sword. And so can dialects with other types of social associations, say, social class and ethnicity. So, for instance, African-American English also gets rated low on correctness scales. At the same time, it has lots of positive connotations, like genuineness and hominess, and also toughness and coolness, a sort of a no-nonsense dialect. Now, linguists know that there's nothing linguistically better or worse about one dialect versus another, or anything tougher or wimpier, for that matter. So what are non-linguists rating when they evaluate different dialects so differently? Language attitudes are attitudes about people, and we carry over the same perceptions and misperceptions, the same stereotypes and prejudices from people to people's linguistic usages. And not only do we judge how people are by their linguistic usages, we also judge who they are. Sociolinguists conduct studies in which they ask non-linguists to identify people's regional origins, ethnicity, sexuality, and other aspects of identity based on dialect alone, or even isolated features of dialect or voice. And often, results are quite accurate. Now, people can put their dialect identification abilities to good use. For example, they might use them to help pinpoint the regional origins of a person making an anonymous threatening phone call. Or they can put their linguistic talents to not so good use. Sociolinguist John Baugh has found that dialect identification, unfortunately, can go hand in hand with dialect prejudice, what he calls linguistic profiling. Now, I'm veering just a bit from dialect mapping here, but I want to close by taking a few minutes to tell you about one of Baugh's studies. The findings are quite revealing, and you'll also be interested to hear what he actually did with his research results. So, Baugh first became concerned with linguistic profiling some years ago when he was searching for housing in predominantly white Palo Alto, California. Now, Baugh is Black, but he speaks not only African-American English, but also white-sounding General American English and Chicano English, the dialect of many Latino Americans in the southwestern U.S. As part of his search, Baugh made phone calls to realtors using standard English and set up a number of appointments. When he got to the houses that were supposedly available, guess what? Suddenly the openings dried up. So what was going on? Baugh surmised that he was being made the victim of housing discrimination. Based on the phone conversations, the realtors thought they were dealing with a prospective white buyer. When they met Baugh in person, saw that he was Black, they steered him away from the houses. Now, being a scientist as well as a house hunter, Baugh turned his negative experiences into a telling experiment. He pretended he was looking for apartments in various Palo Alto area neighborhoods and made phone calls to prospective landlords. This time, he varied which dialect he used. Let's listen. Here's John Baugh using his African-American English dialect.
Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper.
Now here he is again using Latino English.
Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper.
And finally, General American, white-sounding English.
Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper.
So Baugh's experiment got the same results as in real life. When he used the white-sounding dialect, he was usually invited to view apartments. When he used African-American English or Latino English, he was often turned away, sometimes for the same apartment that had just been opened to him as a standard English speaker. The difference in rate of availability based on the different dialects was highly statistically significant, demonstrating two things. One, people make judgments about other people based on dialect alone. Their judgments can be wrong, but they trust them, and they make decisions based on their perceptions, misperceptions, and prejudices. And two, linguistic profiling often leads to linguistic and social discrimination. Now, this might seem like a somber way to end this lecture, but Baugh didn't stop thinking about linguistic profiling once his experiments were over. Instead, he publicized his results, and he worked with the National Fair Housing Alliance to produce a series of public service announcements to help raise awareness of the realities of dialect discrimination and of housing discrimination, and of the fact that race-based discrimination in the U.S. is illegal. Dialect discrimination may still be able to hide behind the guise of regard for proper English, but armed with an accurate view of the nature of regional, social, and ethnicity-based dialect variation, and of people's dialect perceptions, we can begin to root out dialect prejudice. And the mapping techniques we've just discussed in this lecture help sociolinguists investigate these issues and more.